Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, today, our topic, if you guys care to discuss it, will be how to turn or how to convert $1 million into seconds. How to convert $1 million into seconds. And we'll talk about daily income or the new monthly income, or at least my definition of it. And in the scrolling marquee, I've broken it down for you already. But if you're not on the scrolling marquee right here on Blog Talk Radio, then let's see if you can do it yourself. It's not difficult. Anyway, converting $1 million into seconds. What is the answer? 619-768-2945, if you know that answer.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway. And it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it. And said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the dough. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the dough? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it'll come. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he would. I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing. But he spoke to me, and however he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could
punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages. So I called and I punched in the code and the dude said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this is it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back. And I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida. And that night, I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone, I call Chuck Sutton, I say, hey man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I call Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I park my car at the airport. I got it. Got on plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't gonna move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the 6th floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, but I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the 6th floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself, he introduced himself. I'm sitting there, another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduce myself. We don't know each other, ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this four pieces of chicken.
I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they start clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just say, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful. So when people try to figure out how to make $1 million, they have no idea how daunting that is. Because if you know how to make $1 million, you're going to make it tomorrow. But since you can't figure out how to $1 million idea, you go somewhere and sit down. That's the wrong approach. If you apply your gift, your God-given gift that he gave you, you have millions. already at your disposal. If you break it down inch by inch into things of sense for the 10x10 theory, which is very simple. You don't need a $1 million idea. You need a $10 idea. You need something that you do, your gift that God gave you to make $10. That's all you got to be able to know. I don't care if it's cutting hair, cutting somebody's grass, washing somebody's car. I don't care if it's mowing somebody's lawn. I don't care if it's driving people to their destinations. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's baking cookies or pie. You have some braiding somebody's hair. You have something that you can do so well that someone will give you $10 for it. Write my paper for me. Do this for me. Somebody give you $10 for it. Once they give you $10, all you got to do is whatever you did to get that 10, do it 10 more times. You now, my friend, have $100. You have $100 simply because you took a $10 idea and you did it 10 times. Well, guess what? If you take that $100 that you made since you've done it 10 times and you do it 10 more times, I got news for you, my friend. You now have $1,000. $1,000, you make $1,000. Guess what all you got to do? You got to multiply that effort again. Do whatever you did to do $1,000, do it 10 more times. My friend, you now have $10,000. You got $10,000 now. Imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. Just imagine if you was making an extra $10,000 a month. That's $120,000 a year. But I got news for you, my friend. Whatever you did, whatever it took to make yourself $10,000, all you got to do is do it 10 more times. 10 more times, my friend. You now have $100,000. I got news for you now. If you can make $100,000, you're just a step away from being a millionaire, man. Because now you hire a few more people to help you out that you can do portions of what you do so you can duplicate that effort. And one more time, just one more time, do it 10 times. Man, that sounds hard. It is hard. But what else you got to do? What, you going to stop at the 100,000? All you got to do is duplicate your efforts by 10. You duplicate your efforts by 10, 10 times 100,000. Welcome to the club, my friends. You are now a millionaire. Congratulations. You became a millionaire with a $10 idea. So stop bogging yourself down trying to figure out how to make a million. Do what you can do to make $10. And then do the 10x10 theory. Inch by inch, anything's a cinch. Now, here's the joyful part. Along the way, when you was down here making $20,000, but you did right here, and now all of a sudden you're making $30,000. Now you're making $100,000. But on the way to duplicating that times 10, you may stop along in here at $250,000. You got making $250,000 a year. That's way better than that $20,000 you had when you started. So there's joy in the process. Your life is actually a lot richer at $250,000. It'll become even more richer at $500,000. It becomes even richer than that at $750,000, $750,000. If you don't get to the million, man, you gonna trip because you're making $900,000 a year? No, you're gonna be happy. What, you don't make the million, so you only make $700,000 a year? You can't find happiness in $7,000? Something wrong with you, man. There's joy in the process. That's how you make $1 million.
All right. How to make $1 million. Okay. Today I got a question, and I put the answer on a scrolling marquee here on Blog Talk Radio. And we got two figures for you that we want you to convert. And we've done the homework for you in both cases on the scrolling marquee. But if you're not on the scrolling marquee, let's see if you can figure it out on your own. It's really not difficult. Take $1 million and turn it into seconds. Take $1 million and turn it into seconds. And then What's the answer to that? And then take $1 billion and turn it into seconds. What's the answer to that? Right, like, see, on a scrolling marquee, we've done the homework for you. And I bring that up because essentially, inflation is running rampant globally. You know, even if you go into the dollar store, prices have risen. So, people are thinking about new ways. At one time, let's say, from 1938, probably before that, but just what I'm going by. From 1938 to maybe 1958, there were, and I'm going to use TV shows as a barometer, TV shows and films as a barometer. You can live a nice middle-class lifestyle here in the United States off of one paycheck. Now, let me use some, I'm going to use some American-based films and TV shows to illustrate my point. All right. And there were still poor people now during these ages, you know, these years. But I'm just saying. So 1938, I'm going to use a film, the Blondie films, the Blondie and Dagwood movies, starring Penny Singleton as Blondie Bumstead and Arthur Lake as Dagwood Bumstead. They produced the first one of those films in 1938, I believe. All right, in movie theaters. There was a Blondie TV series in 1957. But I'm talking about the movie series, not the TV series. So Arthur Lake, Penny Singleton, the Singleton. So Dagwood Bumstead, Blondie's, let me explain the Bumstead household. Blondie was a housewife. Dagwood, her husband, he had a job. Now, in the movie, because it's a comedy, Dagwood Bumstead was portrayed as a bumbling, sometimes simple-minded man. However, he was married to Blondie, and Blondie was a good-looking woman, with Blondie, thus the name Blondie. And I don't know if that, you know what, I'd have to look that up. What was Blondie's real name? But anyway. Married to Blondie, good-looking woman. And they had two children. Baby Dumpling originally was his nickname. But, you know, his formal name was Alexander. And he had a younger sister. They had a young, which was a daughter of Blondie and Dagwood, Cookie. And they had Daisy and the pups. So Dagwood Bumstead, off of his one paycheck, all right, supported himself, Blondie, Alexander, also known as Baby Dumpling, Cookie, his youngest sister that came along later, and Daisy and the pups. And Daisy had quite a few pups. Well, let's just stop at Daisy. All right, so he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least 5 miles to feed. All right. They lived in a, a nice middle-class neighborhood. Now, Dagwood did not drive. He took the, they didn't have a car. But know he can walk to the bus stop. He caught the bus to work. He worked in town at a construction company. First at J.C. Dithers Construction Company. I think he worked as an office manager. He did have the skill set where he knew how to read blueprints. He knew the code, and like I said, his expertise was in the construction business. And they put up buildings, tall buildings, houses, golf courses, that type thing. And although Dagwood got into a lot of trouble on that job, okay, Dagwood Bumstead always, I mean, he got fired a few times over those movies. Overall, he held down the job, and they were able to take a, you know, take a vacation, you know, all on his paycheck. One paycheck. Now, that's 1938. All right. Now, somewhere in the 50s, I guess, or early 60s. As a matter of fact, let me look it up right now. Another barometer would be the TV show Ozzie and Harriet. So let me look up the dates for that. Ozzie Nelson, who was an actor, but he was also a band leader. Ozzie and Harriet. Let me see. Let me get the date. The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet was the TV show. So let's get the. They did 14 seasons of that, and it started on October the 3rd, 1952. Okay. And during this period of time, 1938, with the, you know, the Dagwood Blondie movie, family TV shows were popular. And actually, they seemed to be always popular. Some kind of way, people like family TV shows. All right. But so 1952, for 14 years, Ozzie and Harriet, where Ozzie, the breadwinner, and he supported himself, his wife, Harriet Nelson. And this is a real life. It was a TV show, but the primary characters, the core characters, were a real family in real life. So, and Harriet was in real life was an actress. But in a TV show, Ozzie, breadwinner, and he supported himself, his wife, and two sons. Rick Nelson, I forgot the other brother's name, David or something like that. Okay. So, and then you also had other shows like Father's Knows Best. You know, Anderson was his last name. I forgot, Jim Anderson. You know, he had a job, took care of the family, sole paycheck. You had I Love Lucy, Ricky Ricardo, worked at a nightclub, was a band leader at the nightclub. His one paycheck, you know, basically supported the family. Lucy at first for many, and then little Ricky came around. And then a lot of the shenanigans that Lucy would get into was she really couldn't budget that pay. Couldn't budget the allowance that he gave her. But essentially, one paycheck. And then their best friends, the Mertzes, Fred owned the building where they lived at. He was a landlord. I guess Ethel helped him. And then Leave It to Beaver, same thing. Jim Cleaver, or Ward, no. The father's name was Ward. Ward Cleaver, married to June Cleaver, and they had the two boys, Wally and the older brother in Beaver. Ward basically, you know, he took a family of four, one paycheck, and they lived in a nice little neighborhood, and I think it had a white picket fence around the house. Even cartoons, the Flintstones, Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble, Burke worked at the quarry, Slate Quarry. and they had each one paycheck, took care of the family, and including the kids, when the kids came along, which was Pebbles and Bam Bam. And then even into the 70s, you had the Brady Bunch, where Mike Brady married, now this was a blended family, as they would call it today. Mike Brady married Carol Brady, and she brought along, Mike Brady had three sons, and Carol Brady had three daughters, and they brought them together. So now Mike Brady was an architect, and maybe he owned the company or whatever, but he was an architect, and he was able to make it home by dinner, okay? And his one paycheck supported himself, Carol, his wife, six children, and he had enough money in there. They had a dog, too. And they had Alice, the housekeeper, Alice was the housekeeper, and she prepared the meals as well. She was Mrs. Brady's assistant. So one paycheck, well, that's two of and she was a live-in mate, so a live-in housekeeper. So one paycheck took care of Mike, the dad, Carol, the wife, Alice, the live-in housekeeper. Okay, that's three. Plus six kids, that's nine. Throwing Fang the dog, I think the dog was Fang. So we're talking about 10 miles to feed off of one paycheck. All right. Now let's go to what year did the Brady Bunch run? Okay. Let's see. The Brady Bunch. All right, September 26, 1969. All right, and it ran until March 8, 1974. Okay, now, I would say, all right, during those periods of times now, inflation was in there all along, but in 1938, matter of fact, let's look at it. Okay. Average price of a house of in 1938. Okay. Let's see. All right, the average cost of a new house in 1937 was $4,100. And the average wages per year in the United States at that time was $1,780. Okay. Now, let's go to 1974, the end of the Brady Bunch era, 1974. Okay. The average price of a house in 1975 was $38,100. All right. So let's go back. Now, I have an inflation calculator on my phone. You can download one of them. I want to say $1,800 for, hold on a minute. Okay, $1,800, okay. All right, so let's go on back to 1938. $1,800, that was the average house in the United States, in a nice, you know, middle-class neighborhood, a Dagwood Bumstead house. Now, what would be the price in 2022? Where we are right now. Excuse me. $1,800 initial year, 1938. So $1,800 for the average house, middle class house in 19. I'm doing something wrong here, okay. I had that wrong. Okay. It was $4,100. Excuse me, I was thinking about the wages. Okay, $4,100. Initially in the year 1938. All right, so today that house would run $80,000. All right. Now, depending on where that house is, in a Chicago, Seattle, or what have you, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, that house might be considerably larger. Now, I don't think they ever named a specific city that the Bumsteads lived in. But, let's take, depending on, and people are listening to this and they live in different price ranges. Matter of fact, let's take, let's say, I'm not too far from Orlando, Florida right now. All right, so let's go with average price of a house. Average price of house, home in Orlando, Florida right now. All right, average price of home, All right, average price of home in Orlando, Florida. All right, the average, in May of 2022, a report showed the median home price in Orlando, Florida was $379,950, which is up nearly $10,000 from April. And a record high for the fourth month in a row. All right. So that's definitely over $250,000. Let's see. Let's pick another market here. Average home price in, let's go with Chicago. Okay. All right, the median listing price of a single-family house in Chicago was $349,900. Okay. Now, another thing I'm reading here says the median home price, or the median home price, in December of 2021 in Chicago, okay, that's a different year. Well, so it went from 200 and, oh, man, what was that price? I lost it that quick. It was like 288,000, but it went up to 349,000. So inflation is outpacing the average paycheck. And you have to have over, it looks like, depending on the city. Matter of fact, let me put in another city. Let's go with Los Angeles. Los Angeles, average price, home price, and let's go with Los Angeles. Oops. Los Angeles, California, 2022. All right, in the last year, the median sale price in Los Angeles, California, rose by 11.2%. Who out here is getting an 11.2% raise on their paycheck if you're working for somebody else? Anyway, rose from, all right, over the last year, the median sale of in Los Angeles rose by 11.2%. It rose from $850,000 in February 2021 to $945,000 in February of 2022 of this year. During the same period, the housing inventory in Los Angeles market, housing market, declined by 41.3% from 6,119 available homes in February 2021 to 3,590 homes in February 2022. Therefore, I ask the two questions. What is the answer? And this is all dealing with inflation, and this affects all of us. When you convert $1 million into seconds, because a lot of people think $1 million is a lot of money, what do you get? Particularly those out there who want to be, or say they want to be, a millionaire. All right. Question is, and there are two questions, and I've given you the answer on Blog Talk, on the scrolling marquee, but for those of you who don't have access to that, what is the answer to these two questions? Because it affects you, believe it or not. $1 million. As a matter of fact, here's another query. First question is, what is the answer if you take $1 million and you convert it into seconds? What's going to be your answer? Second question is, if you had $1 million, what would you do with it? Third question is, $1 billion, convert $1 billion into seconds, what is the answer? You got 2 minutes to figure it out. 619-768-2945. I've given you answers to both of these questions. One question is, what would you do with it?
Bye.
419-768-2945. If you know the answers to the two questions, at least three questions that I asked. Question number one, $1 million. What is $1 million if you convert it into seconds? Question number two, what is $1 billion if you convert it into seconds? And this affects everybody who will listen to this live stream podcast globally, no matter what country you're in. Now, before I give up, and I put out the answer right in the scrolling mark here this live stream today. But before I give the answer for those people who, well, for whatever reason, didn't attempt to figure it out or look on the scrolling marquee where the answer is given, is I'm going to Claude Anderson. Claude Anderson says, in the black community here in the United States, and this is not every black person in the United States, all right, that money basically, when it enters the black community in the United States, this is on a critical mass basis. This is not every individual in the black community in the USA. It's not every black household in the USA. This is on a wide-scale, landscape, critical mass basis. Typically, money moves in and completely out of the black community in the USA within 6 hours worth of time. So, and this could apply to white folks, too, that might live in Appalachia or Los Angeles or Boston or anywhere. But for black folk, it's about 6 hours. A dollar comes in, and then it's out 6 hours and 1 minute later. All right? Whole paychecks gone, evaporated. Now, to simplify this even further, before we get in, and this has everything to do with inflation and the way you're going to basically have to carry yourself from here on out, no, regardless of color. A 1,000 seconds is equivalent to 17 minutes. So just imagine, instead of 1,000 seconds, okay, convert that to dollars, and you got $1,000. So there's a whole bunch of people on the first day of the month, they have $1,000. 10 minutes later or 17 minutes later, that $1,000 that you had when you got paid on the first, that $1,000 is already spent. Matter of fact, oftentimes money is spent before we even get it in our hands. Just people have mentally spent it, and it's somewhere else. So once again, 1,000 seconds is equivalent to 17 minutes. So just convert that 1,000 seconds into minutes, and I think everybody can relate to that, that it doesn't take that long to spend $1,000. You know, you got a car note, that might be $300 or $400. You got rent. Matter of fact, if you just depend on what city you live in, okay, if your rent's I got a friend of mine, his rent's $700 a month. Then he's got to eat. So in less than 17 minutes, that whole $1,000 is gone. All right, now let's crank it back up to the two original questions that I had. Do you want to be a millionaire or a billionaire? Well, you decide after I give the answers. Now, once again, this is on our scrolling marquee. Converting $1 million into seconds, that gives you 12 days. 12 days. $1 million. Now, it depends on the individual and the household. But you might think about, what kind of business can I start where I can earn $1 million within a couple of weeks? Because if you do, you know, if you get sick, you can afford it. or, and we're not talking about a lavish lifestyle. We're not talking about a high-end lifestyle. We're talking about a middle-class income. And by the way, this is looking into the future. What I'm talking about, the day will be coming, the day is coming, where you're going to need a 6 to 7 figure income per month. So $1 million in the seconds adds up to 12 days. Just shy of 2 weeks. So $1 million isn't a whole lot of money. $1 billion in the seconds equals 31 years. So I'm recommending these strategies. Number one, whatever you earn in a year, let's say you earn, I'm going to say $20,000 a year. And to most people, that's probably not a lot of money. But whatever you earn in a year, be it $20,000, $15,000, $50,000, whatever it might be, you need to think of ways where you can legally start earning that amount of money, whatever you earn in a year, and I'm just putting out there $20,000. You need to think about, what can I do to earn $20,000 a month? Or $20,000 a year, because inflation is here, and particularly if you have children or grandchildren, let's say your property taxes are $1,000 a year right now. Okay, they're going to be dramatically higher due to inflation by the time you take over the property, the family house. So you really need to be thinking, I would say, 20 to 30 years out, bare minimum. And that's just due to inflation. That's just due to inflation. So if you got a business, if you're not earning $1 million a month right now, think about what do you, and you know, if anything, make it a social experiment. Write down on a piece of paper, all this is a piece of paper, and what do you need to do where your business could earn $1 million within 2 to 4 weeks, legally? And then there are other people out there to get some clues out there, and they're all over the Internet, particularly YouTube. Seek out people who've done it. I mean, Black Enterprise Magazine has a list of people who've done it and that are doing it. But marinate on it. $1 million in the seconds, that gives you 12 days. And if you think about it, let's say we gave you $1 million right now while you're in good health. But tomorrow you get sick. Not hospital sick, but you're homesick. You're in your home and you're bedridden, and you need nurses. You need people to come in and help take care of you. You know, to have a doctor, they make house calls now. But that might cost you $500 per house call visit. Then that $1 million is reduced by $500. Doesn't seem like a lot, but you don't have $1 million anymore. Then you might spend $600-$700 per week on nurses to come in. All right, so you know you're down $1,000, and let's say you don't have nothing else coming in. Within a short amount of time, depending on how sick you are, that million, you'll see $1 million is not a whole lot of money. Even if you do have insurance, they're going to get you on the deductible and the premium. The insurance companies, matter of fact, an interesting book that you guys might want to read, it's called The Invisible Bankers, which are insurance companies. They're betting that they'll make more money off of your premium before you even get to touch it, even if you ever need to touch it. All right. Anyway, food for thought. Like I say, convert that $1 million into seconds. And the people that really need to look at the difference between the $1 million into seconds and the $1 billion into seconds, those are the people that will get caught flat-footed because they have no idea on how ravishing the power of inflation is. It's quiet, appears to move slow, but then when you have something that happens to you and you don't have the money, then you know what inflation can feel like. Okay, well, that's all I have on my end for today. You need to think about, once again, what's your daily income going to be? Some people need to, a question that I started asking some people these days is, have you ever earned $1 million in a day? I haven't done it yet, but I asked a friend of mine, and last week, matter of fact, and he hadn't done it, but his sister has. They have a law firm. But that's one person I sort of grew up with, and I'm pretty sure she doesn't have $1 million a day every day, and she might not even have $1 million a month every day. But she's pretty consistent at having six-figure months and more than her fair share of million-dollar days within the year. Mignon Francois, who I've mentioned on here several times, the cupcake lady. I'm sure she's had many of six-figure. She probably does six-figure months right now. All right, I don't know if she's had $1 million a day, but she's definitely had six-figure months on a consistent basis, consistent monthly basis. So food for thought, like I say, whatever you make in a year, you need to seriously think about how you can earn that per month or per week or per day. And it's really no rocket science. Now, you might have to get some partners to help you out. But it's a doable deal. Just like I told you about, what do you call it? The term overworked? Not overworked. Overemployed. Look up that term, overemployed. And I talked about this guy last week. He has 11 jobs in 10 different states here in the United States. He earns about at least $1.2 million a year. And how is he able to? He has 11 full-time jobs. How is he able to maintain 11 full-time jobs and in 10 different states? He works remotely. He works from home. Working remotely gives you the opportunity to convert. Well, it allows you to build up to get that $1 million. But start small. Once again, $1,000 in the seconds. $1,000 in the seconds is 17 minutes. You know what? For the reparations people, you need, before you get reparations, I think you need to think about that. Okay, particularly the ones that want to get reparations in the form of a check. All right, take a look at a lot of the lottery winners. A lot of the people that win a lottery, how long do they, how long is, there might be an answer on the internet. How long does the average lottery winner hold on to that money until they're broke? There was a, you met, Matt, oh, let me, I want to read the, I want, because you got to get your head straight first. Forget about being a millionaire. You need to think about the big, once again, a billion dollars converted into seconds gives you over 31 years. Whereas $1 million in the seconds gives you 12 days. Let me see. Let me. All right, let's see. Let me find this dude's name. And I want you to grasp this concept. Okay. Now, this is on YouTube. Not YouTube, but it probably is a YouTube story on it. I'm going to read you something about this guy. His name is Abraham Shakespeare. Abraham Shakespeare. And he was a lottery winner. Just happened to be a black man. He was born on April 24th, 1966. And his sunset was April 7th, 2009. Abraham Shakespeare was a casual laborer here in the United States who won a $30 million jackpot in Florida, receiving $17 million in 2006. In 2009, his family declared him missing. And in January 2010, his body was found buried under a concrete slab in the backyard of an acquaintance. Doris D.D. Moore was convicted of his murder and is now serving a life in prison without the possibility of parole. He died at age 42. Occupation, truck driver's assistant, two sons. All right. Now, and although, you know what, you need to have the mind of a millionaire or a billionaire to even hold on to this stuff. All right, lottery win. The Florida Lotto winning ticket was worth $30 million and was sold at a Townstar convenience store in Frostproof, Florida on November 15th, 2006. On that day, Abraham Lee Shakespeare and co-worker Michael Ford were headed towards Miami when they stopped briefly at a convenience store in Frostproof to buy tickets or to buy drinks and cigarettes. Ford got out of the truck and asked Shakespeare if he wanted the soda. Shakespeare instead wanted Ford to buy him two lottery tickets. I've never bought a lottery ticket because, anyway, for some people, that's the poor man's investment strategy. Anyway, so Shakespeare said that he paid Ford $2 for the ticket out of the $5 he had on him that day. Ford later approached Shakespeare demanding a share of the jackpot for no less than $1 million Well, what did Claude Anderson said? It goes into the black community and comes out within 6 hours. And then for everybody, $1,000 converted into minutes is 17 minutes. I mean, excuse me, $1,000 converted into seconds is 17 minutes. All right. Which Shakespeare refused to pay, prompting Ford to sue Shakespeare, alleging that Shakespeare stole lottery tickets out of Ford's wallet. The jury did not believe Ford's stolen lottery ticket story, and Shakespeare prevailed in courts. Shakespeare had chosen a one-time lump sum payment of $17 million. He moved out of his working-class neighborhood in Lakeland, Florida, into a gated community. Don't we see it? He was spending about a second. Anyway, several months after his lottery win, apart from the million-dollar home, his only major purchases included a Nissan Altima and a Rolex watch from a pawn shop. By late January 2010, the sheriff involved in an investigation of Shakespeare's disappearance, and the lottery money is gone now. Friends stated that Shakespeare had grown frustrated by the apparently consistent appeals for money from both hangers-on and strangers. He told his brother, I would have been better off broke, he told one of his childhood friends. I thought all these people were my friends, but then I realized they just want money. One of these was Dorice Donegan D.D. Moore, who launched a business with Shakespeare, Abraham Shakespeare LLC, giving him control of the firm's funds, giving herself control of the firm's funds. Moore subsequently withdrew $1 million and bought herself a Hummer and a Chevrolet Corvette and a truck before going on vacation. Mind you, this woman's married too. She later claimed that the money was a gift from Shakespeare. Missing status and death. On November the 9th, 2009, Shakespeare's family reported him missing, stating that they had not seen him since April of that year. Family and friends had originally hoped that he had not taken his money and was living on a beach somewhere in the Caribbean Sea. A tip-off led investigators to the backyard. Now, the tip-off is, you know where it probably came from. Somebody who knew what D.D. was doing. And somebody who felt that they didn't get their cut of the money. That was the snitch. They don't say anything. You got to read between the lines. The tip-off led investigators to the backyard of a home purchased by Moore. Now, you know what? I think it probably, because, see, D.D. Moore was married. We'll find out more about her ex or her husband in this. All right, so the tip-off led investigators to a backyard of a home purchased by Moore where Shakespeare's body was found buried under 9 feet of dirt under a newly constructed concrete slab. Shakespeare was just 42. Hillsborough County detectives say Shakespeare died April 6th or 7th in a single-story ranch home in Plant City. Police took Moore into custody on February 2nd, 2010 in connection with the murder of Shakespeare. A judge set a $1 million bond. The police stated that Moore had tried to convince their acquaintances to unearth the body and to move it a week after the death, but had continued to try to convince others that Shakespeare was still alive. On February 19, 2010, Moore was formally charged with first-degree murder. Now, what came out, and I'm trying to find a part right now. After Moore killed him, after Moore killed him, she called, and I'm trying to get that part for you guys. She called her husband to dig a hole. The husband claimed that he didn't know why he dug the hole. But she called him, and she dug a hole. I mean, she got her husband to dig a hole. And I guess she struggled to, even she by herself struggled to get his body into the hole. Now, the husband dug the hole and left. That's what he says. And so either Dee Dee Moore killed him, and she got convicted of killing him, and she struggled to put the body in the hole, or she got some help in putting Shakespeare in the hole, in the ground. But somewhere along the line, somebody felt that, wait a minute, I didn't get my cut. I know what you did. Okay. Or you promised me a certain amount of money, or I demanded a certain amount of money, and if you don't pay me, I'm snitching. Because, once again, the article says, you know, the police got an anonymous tip. And that's what was in that Godfather movie? You know, you got it, whoever betrays you is going to be somebody close. So whoever made that anonymous tip about his body and where he was buried, it had to be somebody that had something to do with or knew about what Dee Dee Moore did. So in any event, long story short, she's in prison now. I don't know what happened to her husband, because he was the one that dug the hole. But like I say, he claimed that all he dug was the hole, and then he left. So I'm saying all that to say this. Okay. Dee Dee Moore, who's now in some kind of federal prison for the rest of her life, she didn't know anything about how to convert $1 million into seconds, let alone $1 billion into seconds. And Abraham Shakespeare, and let me colorize this because we're in the United States. Abraham Shakespeare, that was his name. Abraham Shakespeare, according to Wikipedia, and you can read, just look up, and you can read the whole thing for yourself. Abraham Shakespeare, go on Wikipedia, read the whole story about Abraham Shakespeare. He was a 42-year-old black man. According to the Wikipedia article, they said he was illiterate. So, in a general sense of the word, illiterate, he had $30 million. He was a lottery ticket winner. And I can guarantee you, if he was basically illiterate, he was financially illiterate. He did not know that $1 million isn't a whole lot of money. $1 million is worth about 17 days of your time. That's it. And most Americans live that way. Most Americans who buy a house have to get a mortgage. If you have to get a mortgage, but you know what? Credit and mortgages are for broke people. They don't have the cash. They don't have the cash or the social capital resources to get what they want. So, it might seem simple, but once again, you can start off with, and once again, let's just look at it. $1,000 into seconds is 17 minutes. Next time you get $1,000 in your hand, or if you got $1,000, matter of fact, if you got a car note or a mortgage note or whatever, because it's, what's today's date? All right, today's September the 12th. Okay. Next month, if you got $1,000 worth of bills, that money's already spent. It's already spent. So, and it's not even the middle of this month yet, let alone October. It takes about 17 minutes or less to spend $1,000. So you need to be thinking in terms, because inflation is real. All right. You need to be thinking about in terms, to be honest about it, you need to start, what can you do to be worth a billion and have something rolling in where, like I say, if you, whatever you earn in a yearly basis, you need to be thinking about how much can I, what do I need to do so I can start earning that in a month, a week, or even a day. And often think about what Claude Anderson says, you know, that 6-hour rule. Now, that's 6 hours max. For some people, everything flows out within 17 minutes, and for figures larger than $1,000. But read the Abraham Shakespeare debacle, or whatever you want to call it. Sad story. Sad story. That his life was ended at 42 years old over $30 million that they won on a lottery ticket. And I would say to some, not all, but before you get that, what do you call it, that reparations check? Before you get that reparations check, how quick are you going to spend that? Because we're not entitled to one. If you think about it, a second is very precious. We're not entitled. We're not entitled to the next second. There's somebody that was here just a second ago. They're not here now. Anyway, play around with it. $1 million in a second, that it gives you 12 days. That's all it is. $1 million is 12 days. In some kind of way, particularly if the world we live in, when you borrow money from a bank, you're borrowing time off of your life. Anyway, that's all I got to say about it. So, if you got any trending topics, just press 1 or call in 619-768-2945. And if you can, look at, we can do a whole series on it, but anyway. All right, 6197, if you got any trending topics, announcements, or whatever to make, just give us a call. We'll hear what you got to say.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth 1,000 words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back, telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, You see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
Shit, dude. She just hit you in your face. Shit, dude. Your ass. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. What I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all. Real quick. Just like this.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Okay, 407, your mic is open.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for stopping that noise. Oh, boy. Thank you, L.A., for a good show. And I just wanted to share my experience this morning with the Female Solution. Zelda, our Monday morning mindfulness host, had on the psychiatrist, Zalid Scott, I think is his name. I mean, I could just feel the stress in his voice as he shared how he's been treating veterans. He works at the VA part of his job. Plus, he has clients and friends who are really stressed in Chicago. I mean, I could just feel the stress in the frustration in his voice this morning like I've never heard. Usually, he's very calm, fairly calm, giving advice about, you know, whatever the topic is. But this morning, oh my goodness, he was really stressed. So I thought about the fact that part of the problem, especially in the Black community, that he's facing and many people are facing is that we got a lot of people with PTSD, not only from joining the military. You know, it's one thing to volunteer to go to Vietnam or Iraq or whatever, but they got stress and PTSD from just living in that urban environment where somebody shared that a woman called the police to get help for a man because a man was beating up on a woman, and the police never showed up. They called back like 40 minutes later or something and said, well, is he still beating her up? It's like, what? So the craziness that's going on in the city, and like that audio was suggesting, the inability of people in the urban environment, I don't care what color they are, to leave that environment is really interesting. And, you know, no judgment, because some people have all kind of reasons why they don't want to leave Chicago and its craziness. I had the privilege and the blessing to leave very early in my life because I married a man and we got out of town. But the reality that there a lot of people are facing now is the stress of living in an urban environment and the mental slavery that I'm hearing and the stress that goes along with that. So I'm just encouraging you to keep up the good audio you play and the motivation you put out there, because people are really stuck either with PTSD or just mental slavery of not being able to see. You got other choices. You don't have to live in this urban jungle. And that's what it sounded like this morning when Khalid Scott was describing his job for the last several weeks of not only dealing with couples and frustrations of veterans and all that, but just the whole damn Chicago environment. And it ain't going to get no better. I had some, you know, I'm hearing a lot about there are certain cities that are going to be targeted to create even more chaos. So thank you for your continued motivational.
The live in it, well, Pleasant Stephens said this years ago. He said basically to live in a lot of your larger cities, not the smaller ones. You have over 19,000 of them in the United States to pick from. You like Chicago, Seattle, Orlando, Miami, Dallas, San Antonio, Boston, those places. You really need to be wealthy, maybe not rich, but wealthy to live in those cities just due to the price of housing alone. It's expensive.
Okay, so it depends on what section of the city you're in. The south side of Chicago is probably not as expensive as the north side, because the north side has a lot more development and renovations and all the things that north siders want. They paying for it. But if you live on the south side, that's where it gets to be a lot more stressful. You might be able to afford it, but you got some crazy Negroes down there on the south side killing and shooting up.
Well, it all
the
depends
side.
On because the all right, when I was last there. Now, Pleasant Stephens, I think he lives in southeast Chicago, if I remember correctly. So his neighborhood is basically a quiet neighborhood with nice middle-class brick homes. I mean, it was super quiet over that way. So
okay, but here's
I don't know, but I don't know Chicago. What's the rough part of Chicago?
Okay, so somebody mentioned today, I think it was Khalid Scott, the psychiatrist, in Hyde Park, where Obama's house is in Hyde Park. His old
now, is
house
that
is in
west
Hyde
side
Park.
Or what? Is that west side
no,
of
that's
the Chicago?
East, that's side, no, that's east side, middle kind of middle of Chicago, east side, but near the lake.
Okay.
Okay, Obama, I grew up in that neighborhood. I went to Kenwood High School, which was a very diverse population of students, a lot of them from the University of Chicago families. I mean, we had every race you could imagine in our classes in high school. This last week or two, they had a shooting at Met High School, which is like, what? Kenwood was one of the most, I don't know if you would say elite high schools, at least the neighborhood is very high, upper middle class neighborhood. So, and Hyde Park is where University of Chicago kind of runs the whole place, and they're having violence even in that neighborhood. So it just kind of alerts you to what's really going on, that things are changing. Even in Hyde Park, you would never expect that because Hyde Park is heavily policed. University of Chicago has a lot of money. You got to have money to just live in Hyde Park. It's like that's the environment today. In that neighborhood. Where
all right,
you
now
be
I'm reading what you said. All right, I got a headline here. Kenwood High School community member shot multiple times, dies on south side, officials say.
So I'm just saying people don't realize or don't want to accept the fact they have choices. You don't have to live in the urban areas, but they're stuck for some reason, family, jobs, whatever. So
well,
just,
it's something
that
you said before. People are addicted to the comfort and conveniences of an urbanized area. They don't want to.
So,
many people don't want to drive 30 minutes to an hour outside of where they live.
And they're not going to want to live in some little town in Mississippi that has hardly, 10 people in the population until they suffer enough is how I see it. Until the suffering gets to a high level, they're going to want to stay in the city. And then once the suffering gets to a high level, then maybe they'll think about moving out in a little town in Mississippi or wherever that has more peace and quiet. But right now, you're right. They're so addicted to that lifestyle and that comfort and convenience that even then when there's gunshots all around them, people dying, violence all around them, they still are not motivated to leave that environment, which is very toxic right now.
And if the young man's name was Kanye Perkins. He was 17. He was pronounced dead at 12:18 p.m. this past Friday, according to Cook County Medical Examiner.
Was that the victim or the shooter that killed?
Well, Kanye.
Which one?
Let's see. They said Kanye Perkins, 17, was. I think he was the one that was. He was the victim.
Okay, so did they catch the shooter?
Oh, let me read the rest of the article. Minutes after noon, he was DOA. Chicago police. Sorry, Perkins was shot in the head while standing outside. The unknown offender approached and began firing rounds at the victim. The assailant fled and possibly a dark-colored vehicle, but no one has been arrested, according to Tannenhill. That's the police person, spokesperson. As of whenever this article was released on Yahoo, no.
So, anyway, I just wanted to remind all of us who are conscious to keep up our royal energy of love, compassion, and smiling at people. You know, when you go out, you never know what your cash register at Publix or grocery store is going through. And it just helps to be mindful that everybody we meet on the street might be going through something really depressing, sad, whatever, to just smile and compliment people. I do that. I am committed when I go to the grocery store to make sure I call and speak the name of the person, the bagger, and thank them for whatever they did. Even if they made a mistake, I thank them for whatever they did to help me have a pleasant experience in that store. Because we just don't know what people are going through when they come put on that public uniform or mask or whatever. And our job, especially as blog talk hosts, is to keep the vibration up and motivate people to be their best and take advantage of opportunities that will make their life better. So thank you, L.A., for the
I'm trying to figure out why are people shooting each other now, because, you know, the times have changed. I mean, a lot of people don't walk around with cash anymore.
Well, that's a million-dollar question, L.A. People are on drugs. Plus, they're on this crappy food, chemicalized food that is affecting their brains. I look at the about. I might. My son had a thing of Pringles on the table. He's big in the junk.
You know what Pringles could be used as? You can add water to that and use it to glue up a building. Pringles is the packaging, but I wouldn't. Pringles taste nasty. That's cardboard.
I'm trying to point out, L.A., people take in their body all day long with the food they eat alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what other drugs they're doing or what other movies or entertainment they're watching. So there's so many temptations out there to comfort the body, comfort the mind, whether it's drugs, food, whatever. We don't know why people are shooting until you sit them down and ask them, what the hell was in your mind that you want to pull out a gun and shoot somebody? We won't know. Because every situation is different, I think. You don't know whether they're going through stress at home, mom, dad, husband, wife. We don't know until we sit down. All we can do is put out good, positive vibes when we do go out so that we are not contributing to this negativity mm-hmm. and this violence and all the other factors out there, Pringles and everything. We just have to balance it with our own positive, loving, compassionate, wise energy. Otherwise, we're contributing to the...
All right. Well, thank you for the feedback. Everyone have a good rest of the day.